From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. To write about your life at the age of 29, you better have had an interesting first arc. If the rest of Kwame Onwuachi's life is anything like his first two decades, there will be much, much more to come.
I just kept cooking. You know, I just put my head down and kept cooking, whether it was at home or, you know, in other friends' restaurants. I just kept putting my head down.
Chef Kwame Onwuachi writes about facing adversity in his memoir, Notes from a Young Black Chef. But I'm happy to say there's more to the story. Not long after we recorded this interview, he won the James Beard Award for Rising Star Chef. Hi.
Hello.
You come from a long line of cooks. In fact, you spent a lot of your childhood in the kitchen with your mom, right?
Yes, I did. I spent a lot of time with my mom. She started a catering company from our apartment in the Bronx, and my sister and I became her first two employees, essentially.
Indentured servant, some people would
say. Exactly. Exactly. Do not think it was legal, but shout out to mom. She kept me away from doing laundry and handed me some shrimp to peel. So
there
I'll take
go.
It.
Hey, it's skills that have done well for you.
Absolutely.
But it took you a while to really focus your attention on the kitchen as a calling for you.
Mm-hmm.
Could you sort of take us through what flipped the switch for you? What made you decide to really start to focus on the kitchen?
It's a funny story, actually. I was walking through Soho and walked into a small boutique, and it was a brand new store, so I was just checking it out. I struck up a conversation with the store clerk. She said she was the owner of the store, and I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. She's like, yeah, you know, I'm doing a launch party. You want to come? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. She's like, yeah, I'm just looking for a caterer, though. That's the only thing I need for this party. And I, for some strange reason, I was like, I'm a caterer. And she was like, you're a caterer? How old are you? And I was like, ma'am, that is irrelevant, okay? I'm a caterer. I'm a chef. What do you need? And she was like, well, I'm really looking to do, like, these small little strawberry cheesecakes. Do you know how to make strawberry cheesecakes? I was like, please do not disrespect me, ma'am. I said I was a chef and a caterer. I know what I'm doing. I'll be here at 10 a.m. tomorrow. We'll do a tasting. I was like, I'll see you back here at 10 a.m. She's like, all right, perfect. I got home. I was freaking out because I never made a cheesecake before. So I called my sister up and she gave me a cheesecake recipe. If you've ever made a cheesecake before, it takes a couple hours to really figure out after you've even baked it if the texture is right because you have to cool it. So it took me like 3 or 4 tries. And, you know, that's like 9 to 12 hours later. And it's like 10 a.m. and I finally have this perfect cheesecake. And at that moment, I realized that I need to be doing this for the rest of my life because I spent countless hours just focusing on this one thing, trying to perfect it. And I never sat down for that long a period of time without being on my phone, without going on the internet, without calling someone, without listening to music. I was just focused on perfecting this. And it was that moment that I fell in love with cooking.
How old were you?
I was 19, 20.
Wow. I mean, you walked into this store as a total stranger.
Yeah.
And this woman put her launch into your hands.
Mm-hmm.
You must have some real persuasive ability.
Yeah. I mean, I was very confident. You know, I had to back it up and I stayed up all night in order to perfect it. And then the, you know, the event was a couple weeks later. So I had, you know, some time to really hone it. But yeah, I mean, she put her trust into me and I became the official caterer of the store. I did the event and went off without a hitch. And then I was like, okay, I really want to do this, but I need capital to launch this business. And it came to me and a little kid walking onto the train selling candy. And I quickly calculated how much money he made in a minute. And then I calculated that by 60 and saw how much he made in an hour. Then I calculated that by times that by 8 and saw how much he could potentially make a day if he put his all into it. And I went and quit my job the next day and bought a bunch of candy and got on the train and sold candy in order to start my catering business.
How long were you selling candy?
I was selling it for 2 months. I had a rude awakening on the dynamics of candy selling and how organized it was. And I had no idea as a passerby.
So interesting. I love people's lives. The twists and turns are just fascinating. Let's go back a bit. your mother at a certain point sent you off to live with your grandfather in Nigeria, presumably to learn respect.
Yes, to learn respect. I wasn't the best kid growing up, you know, veering off on the wrong path a couple times. And she had had enough and didn't want to see me, you know, in jail or in a body bag. So she sent me to live with my grandfather. She did not disclose how long I was going to be there, though, because I would not have gotten on the plane. She told me the duration of time that I was going to be there.
Yeah, you thought it would just be a summer, and it turned out to be 2 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Nigerian experience, how did it play into your passion for food, piggybacked on growing up in your home and experiencing the food in that way?
Well, I was fascinated by the food, you know. At first, I was not attracted to the food at first. It was, you know, a lot of different smells that I wasn't used to and textures. And I had to get used to it quickly, you know, after I found out I wasn't only going to be there for the summer. And for 2 years, I had to eat, you know. And with that, I had to raise livestock. You know, we had to go and cultivate certain vegetables to go in some traditional soups and sauces. So I learned the how behind cooking and, like, how hard it is to raise an animal. I mean, if we want Super Bowl Sunday 30 wing bucket, you know, we had to raise, like, you know, 15 chickens. So there was a real tangible life at the end of a meal, or even energy that went into it, whether it was a vegetable-based meal, that really trickled into my profession quite seamlessly.
Aside from the Nigerian influence, what other influences do you take to the plate at your current restaurant, Kith & Kin, in D.C.?
Well, we have like four pillars of cuisine there. It's Nigerian, Jamaican, Trinidadian, and Creole. And then we play with the diaspora and American South and any place that's been touched by the slave trade.
So I understand that at a certain point in your media career, let's say, mm-hmm. a producer said to you that America wasn't ready for a black chef in fine dining.
Mm-hmm.
And encouraged you to cook, quote, black food, meaning fried chicken, cornbread collards, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be chicken and waffles that got you eliminated from the show.
Mm-hmm.
What was your reaction to such comments? And did the result of being eliminated after making the fried chicken and waffles kind of light a fire under you to just follow what you knew you had to do?
So to answer the first question, yeah, at that time, it was when I cooked for that producer and they said that, I knew I couldn't compromise who I was. It wasn't, that's not true to who I am. So I was going to make it there regardless of, you know, me cooking chicken and waffles or soul food or me cooking the food that I really wanted to cook. And at that time, I was really trying to hone my craft. So I wasn't going to misstep and do something to, you know, jeopardize my character. But, you know, on Top Chef, Top Chef is just a very high intense. It's a lot harder than it looks. So, you know, they show us really quickly, you know, coming up with the dish and then, you know, trying it out. But it's a lot of pressure. So that's what I thought to do in the moment. And it was obviously not the right choice. I should have just made the waffles from scratch. I mean, looking back on it now.
We can always look back.
Exactly.
After a successful tour of the pop-up series Dinner Lab, you were approached by investors to open Shaw Bijou.
Mm-hmm.
And you left most of the pre-opening details to your partners when you left to film Top Chef.
Mm-hmm.
A Washington Post food critic, Tom Sietsema, reviewed the 8-table restaurant on the first night of service, and then it closed a few months later. Having had failure in my life, I understand the devastation of that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
How did you kind of shake it off and go forward and dig in and bounce back so incredibly?
Well, one, I would have to credit the amazing people that I have around me, the friends that I have around me. At some point, I still truly believe that they believe in me more than I believe in myself, my family as well. And they are the ones that pushed me. But also at a certain point, you have to stop feeling sorry for yourself and understand the real gift that you've been given is life. And you have, you know, as long as you're here, you have time to do anything you really put your mind to.
You've been pretty vocal about the high octane and volatile elements of Michelin-starred kitchens that you've worked in, that some rank on the world's best restaurant list, like Per Se, 11 Madison Park. Do you think this comes with the territory, or is there a way to achieve that height without that level of scary intensity?
I think the intensity, it comes with the territory for sure. I think the level of being, how can I put this the best way?
Abused?
Yeah, being abused, or being respectful of the people that are, you know, working so hard for you. That's not necessary. Being firm is necessary in a kitchen. You know, I say with any profession, when you're at a high level, but treating people with respect and dignity, I think that is necessary for success.
So talk to me a bit about Kith and Kin. How did this opportunity come up? It's a restaurant that sits inside a hotel, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Kith and Kin is a restaurant that's inside of a hotel. I was approached by the Intercon. Actually, you know, I was when I was really, really low and depressed after the Strawberry Zoo closed, I got a direct message, like a DM, like someone slid in my DMs and said, you know, we're looking to open up, you know, some hotel opportunities. Would you be interested in, you know, doing a restaurant with us? And I didn't respond for many reasons. One, it was just like, I don't know who this person is. But two, I looked at the name and the guy's name was Mustafa. I don't know many people named Mustafa. And then the person was white, so I don't know if there are any white people named Mustafa. So I thought it was like a joke, like a friend of mine playing a trick on me or something. So I never responded. And then I responded after, you know, a couple weeks, and then they were like, hey, let's meet up. And we met up down at the wharf, and they showed me the bare bones of the building. And they're like, this could be yours, you know? And I looked at it, you know, spent some time thinking it over with my fiance, and decided to go for it.
Describe what we might find on the menu.
So the menu is Afro-Caribbean. So you'll find things that reflect my upbringing, which is like Nigerian, Jamaican, Trinidadian, and Creole. So you'll find jollof rice. You know, you'll find curry goat with dal puri roti. You'll find braised oxtails, jerk chicken, a goosey stew. So you'll find some of the classics, and then you'll find stuff that we're a little bit more playful with, which is like marinated avocado and Persian cucumber salad with green seasoning, which is a Trinidadian marinade, and a gooseberry piri piri. So you'll find stuff like that. You'll find, you know, calamari veracruz. You'll find charred brassicas with the toasted coconut and scotch bonnet syrup with romesco sauce. So you'll find a little bit of everything. There's something on the menu for everyone.
And this is within a lens of fine dining. The plating is quite considered and beautiful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm just fascinated that you, I opened my first restaurant. I was 31. But it seems to me that you have something, you have a focus and a drive that is rare in one so young. So I want to thank you for writing these notes. I would imagine it's the first iteration of your memoir, kind of like Ruth Reichel.
Yeah, I think so. I would hope so. I get to, you know, write a second one, notes from a middle-aged black chef or something like that.
Yeah. So, talk to me about people of color in your kitchen. Are other black chefs drawn to you to work for you, with you?
I'd say so. I have a pretty diverse kitchen, but a lot of them are African-American, and they're drawn to me for some reason. You know, I think it's a little bit of familiarity that they can be comfortable and just seen as, you know, another cook or another chef.
And how important is that for you to model a different way?
That's the reason why I'm doing this. You know, that's the reason why, one of the reasons why I wrote this book and thought it was so important, because we need more role models in this industry of color, and we need more safe zones as well.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's James Beard Award-winning chef Kwame Onwuachi of Kith and Kin in Washington, D.C. His memoir is Notes from a Young Black Chef. In a moment, I'm talking with one of Mexico City's most exciting chefs, and soon she'll be opening a restaurant here in L.A. My conversation with Gabriela Cámara of Contramar after the break. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman.
And we just thought it would be very cool to have the food that we would eat on the beach in the city, because you could find fresh seafood and fish that you couldn't really eat at restaurants.
That's Mexico City chef Gabriela Cámara. 2 decades ago, a sublime experience of ceviche and tostadas on a Zihuatanejo beach inspired her to open Contramar, which became one of Mexico City's most acclaimed restaurants. Now Gabriela is sharing her recipes that make guests feel as if they're lunching on a beach holiday in one of the busiest and craziest cities on the planet. Her cookbook is called My Mexico City Kitchen. It's so great to have you here.
I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, you're going to be coming here a lot, I hear.
I am, yes.
We'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The introduction to your book is titled Not Your Typical Mexican Girl. Mm-hmm. So explain that to me.
You know, I was born in Mexico. I was born in the north of Mexico in Chihuahua. Even though none of my parents were from there, my father is from Mexico City. My mother is from Florence, Italy. So I've always been living in Mexico as a Mexican, but with a little bit of a foreign, I mean, not a little bit.
Je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, I mean, with a foreign background. And then I was raised in a town close to Mexico City called Tepoztlán in Morelos, south of Mexico City. Beautiful town in a valley surrounded by incredible mountains. It has an Aztec pyramid, and we were a family that was not the average family living there full time. Most people would go to Tepoztlán from the city only on weekends, but we lived there full time. And
both your parents worked?
Both my parents worked. So I was the only person with a mother who worked, let alone left the town to go to Mexico City to work every day. So we were always sort of the black sheeps in a way, in a very good way.
I was going to say that aside from not fitting in and those feelings, there must have been some freedom to that identity.
So much. And my parents are extremely cool people that really, I think, looked after my brother and me in the best of ways.
You say that you grew up in a hippie house.
Yes, I did. My parents built their first house where I was born, and then my brother was born in Chihuahua with their hands, literally. They made these blocks. They had ferro cement domes that my father built. We had, you know, a solar oven, solar heating water system. Then when we moved to Tepoztlán in Morelos, there's a long rainy season, and then there's a long dry season. So we had like water from the rain season that we collected, or that we still collect. My parents still live in that house.
So your connection to cooking, I know when you were little, uh-huh, that a housekeeper who worked for your family taught you how to make tortillas. Mm-hmm. But you didn't have a mom in the kitchen. So were you intrigued by the women who are making food for your family? Did you hang out with them? What was your connection to actually making food?
Since I can remember, I really loved food. And I loved watching adults cooking. And I loved watching my grandmother. My maternal grandmother spent a lot of her time in our house. She would come for the winter.
But so, she was not making sopes.
Yes, no, she was not.
She was baking
beautiful crostatas, and she was making pasta, and she was making, you know,
Italian things.
And growing things in the garden, Italian things that weren't typical of Mexican cooking. But I was also very much in touch with my father's sisters, who were extraordinary cooks. After my grandmother passed away, all her recipes and her food teachings went to my aunts. And I loved being with them. I loved going to their house and just spending the day or the afternoon being with them in the kitchen. And I wanted to learn. So they would really take the time to teach me. And, you know, my grandmother, my Italian grandmother, was not a patient person. She was very much of a perfectionist. You know, she didn't want kids around when she was cooking, but she let me.
So you opened Contramar in Mexico City 21 years ago.
Yes. This summer, it will be 21 years.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yes.
I was there several weeks ago, and can attest to its aliveness.
Yes.
It's such an amazing space because it's huge and it's one room and there's so many voices, and yet it's intimate and feels good. You feel so taken care of there.
I love that you say that. That is a lovely description. That's exactly what I would want you to feel or experience there.
What was the aha moment? What made you decide 21 years ago, as a person who didn't have restaurant experience?
None.
To take on this challenge?
It was really a leap of faith and a total experiment. We were four partners. We were all young. Only one of the four original partners had like cafeteria and sort of small bistro experience as an owner, not even as a cook or as a, you know, front of house person. And we just thought it would be very cool to have the food that we would eat on the beach in the city, because you could find fresh seafood and fish that you couldn't really eat at restaurants. Restaurants at that, you know, in the 90s.
They were either very high end, right?
Yes. Or they were food stalls in markets. Or fondas, or, and you didn't get like good quality fish.
It's so interesting.
Easily. It still is tricky to get good quality fish. So, I feel everywhere.
So yes, everywhere. But the sustainability part?
Yes.
How do you deal with that in Mexico?
Well, we more and more have through the years started working with cooperatives and small groups of fishermen along the coast of Mexico. There are many problems with eating fish, but there are also many wonderful groups of people doing extraordinary things about fishing, you know, the right species, the right time, the right size, the right amount, and in all sorts of different projects.
So what is the difference between the kind of food that you serve at Contramar, which is this very direct link to beach eating, and Cala in San Francisco, which is more modernist? Is that what you would say?
Yeah. I mean, Cala is a restaurant I opened 18 years after I had opened Contramar. So a lot happens in 18 years. And a lot has happened in the food industry in the past 25 years, I would say. So it's right in the middle of that. I think even though Contramar keeps on being pertinent and sort of up to date in different ways, Cala is a much more, I mean, first of all, it's a restaurant of the Bay Area. Mostly we get fish from the Bay Area and from Monterey and from Half Moon Bay and from, you know, it's really, really local. I've incorporated many, many, many more vegetables and fruits from the markets and the farms around San Francisco. It's a more minimalist menu in a way, but it's a more sophisticated menu also. It's a more, I would just say it's a menu that was done 18 years later.
And it's also an experience more of fine dining than
yes.
of eating.
Contramar was always conceived as an interpretation or a take on Mexican beachside palapas in the center of the city.
Which is just an awesome way to eat. Let's talk about the food.
Yes. So, you know, from the beginning, we had freshly made tortillas, which was something that was not common at all 20 years ago in Mexico City. You did not find good tortillas. It wasn't easy to find good tortillas, either refried black beans or whole black beans, a fresh grilled fish and salsa in a taco.
Really great fresh grilled fish.
Yes.
Really great sauces.
Yes.
Contramar's signature dish probably is the pescado de la talla.
Pescado a la talla. Yes.
Yeah.
And that means, a la talla means rubbed with chile sauce.
It's like the Instagram darling of your restaurant.
It is the Instagram darling of my restaurant.
Because it's one side of it is red and one side of it is green.
Yep. The traditional is red chiles. And I added the green because we wanted it to be appealing for everybody, even for people who didn't eat chile. And we wanted it to be appealing for this very cosmopolitan
audience
that Mexico City has always had.
So I'm just going to throw out some of the stuff that I put bookmarks in that I'm going to be making. So you have in there a milanesa torta.
Yes.
But it has chilaquiles in it.
Yes.
Okay, so I think this is a genius idea.
Which was not my idea. It's something that happens. It's something that they make. There's a very, very popular food stall. Food, like it's a table on the on a corner in the Condesa neighborhood in Mexico City, very close to where I live. And these ladies, these sisters and their mother, make this amazing torta with chicken milanese and chilaquiles. And it is so good.
So, you know, we of course have all kinds of grocery stores here. And in the Mexican grocery stores in this time of year, actually, you start to see verdolagas, purslane.
Yes. Yes.
So I know that a lot of Los Angeles cooks look at this vegetable and they have no idea what to do with it. Can you describe what it is and then tell us how you serve it?
Well, purslane is actually a succulent. It grows everywhere. It's sort of a weed.
It is a weed, yeah.
Yes. And so as succulents are, it's savory and it holds water in the thick leaves. So it has a bite to it. And it's also very acidic and savory. I love it raw. In salads, I love it as a topping for tostadas or as a topping for a taco. But I also love it cooked. And one of my favorite Mexican recipes is pork ribs in salsa verde with verdolagas. And I make a version of that with fish at Contramar.
I understand that soon we will have your presence here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Are you at liberty to talk about this yet?
I am.
You have an interesting partner in this enterprise.
Yes. Jessica Coslow from Squirrel and I will be partnering in this restaurant, in the restaurant of the proper hotel that will be opening in Santa Monica this summer. So,
and can you give us an idea of what the menu point of view will be?
The menu point of view will be, as Jessica and I always say, a conversation between two sister cities, which have been sister cities for so long. And in this time, these political times, it is so important for us to reinforce that dialogue. You know, Mexico City is the largest city with a Mexican population, but LA is the second largest city with a Mexican population. So
I feel like we live in northern Mexico. We're in Alta California.
Yes.
It's been so lovely to meet you and have you here. Thank you, Gabriela.
Thank you for having me here. It's an honor to be here.
Gabriela Cámara is the executive chef and owner of Contramar and Cala, respectively in Mexico City and San Francisco. Her cookbook is My Mexico City Kitchen. Keep your eyes peeled for her new Santa Monica restaurant with Jessica Coslow called Onda. Coming up, it's Memorial Day weekend, which is the perfect time to fire up the grill. I'm talking steak with the master of meat, Aaron Franklin, after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
You know, I've got a pretty good case of dad bod going on. I think beer and steaks are kind of where it's at for maintaining.
Ask Aaron Franklin how he maintains his physique, and he will answer steak and beer. The man behind the eponymous Franklin's Barbecue recently admitted he doesn't eat his slow and low meats and prefers the fast cook of a steak. So much so that his latest cookbook is a ballad to beef. Written with Jordan McKay, the book is called Franklin Steak. Hi there.
Well, hello, hello.
I understand that your father was the manager of a steakhouse in Bryan, Texas.
That's true.
So what are your memories of that experience as a kid?
You know, so when I was born, he was the manager of a steakhouse. And I don't remember much of those days, but I do remember, you know, growing up, of course, you know, on Friday nights, my dad would pick up a couple T-bones, fire up the grill, use about a stick of butter on there, and they were pretty darn good.
Was your interest in steak because you were tired of barbecue, or did you really look at how you were eating and think about how there was as much to learn about steak and tinkering of it as with low and slow barbecue?
Well, so I've been cooking barbecue for about 16 years now, and been cooking steak since, you know, ever since I can remember, really. But when Jordan McKay and I were working on the barbecue book, we found ourselves every day kind of going back to my house, talking about stuff, grilling steaks, and really, we kind of bonded over that and got pretty excited about steaks. And, you know, around that time, kind of started joking about doing another book one day about steak. And then about 3 years later, called up and publisher called up, like, hey, what do you guys think about doing a steak book? Ah, we've been thinking about it. Funny you should ask.
So I have to ask you, when you think of steak, is your steak always thick and then sliced? like roast beef, or is having a thin steak permissible?
Well, first off, I think it depends on what you can get. You know, if you go to the store and it's a really thin flank steak, or maybe it's a flat iron or a bevette or a small hanger, something like that, which is kind of usually what I gravitate towards anyway for just home cooking. You know, if you go to the store and you got to feed a bunch of people, you might look for a large ribeye or something like that. So I kind of try to let the meat tell me what to do.
So let's talk about different cooking methods, because that's all about getting texture and doneness. Are there preferred methods for different cuts?
I'm glad you asked. Really, so the kind of the way we broke down the book is that, say, there are five different cuts of meat, and then we kind of showcase five different ways to cook those pieces of meat. But you can kind of mix and match whatever. It's more just kind of developing a bag of tricks. Like, you see a piece of meat at the grocery store, somebody gives you a tri-tip or whatever, you know, it'd be cool to know how to cook it without having to look on the internet too much. But yeah, I mean, they're, you know, I prefer grilling everything over wood coals. I think that's the best flavor. But then sometimes with a large cut of meat, you might kind of part cook it. You might cook it real slow, let it stop, then pick it back up on a really, really hot grill when your guests arrive. Or if it's a little piece of meat, you might leave it in the refrigerator. You might salt it, put it in the refrigerator, and put it on the grill ice cold so you can kind of get a good crust without overcooking the inside. So I think the technique kind of depends on what the piece of meat wants.
So you're telling us that we can pre-cook a steak.
Oh, for sure. Larger pieces. I think that's a great way to cook big bone-in ribeyes and stuff like that, tri-tips, larger pieces of meat, because you can just cook them to a pretty low temperature, let them sit for a little bit, not too long, and, you know, it beats having everybody stand around a grill for an hour waiting for dinner.
What about people who, and there are those, who just can't face the grill for whatever reason?
Well, they're not that intimidating. it's just fire. No big deal. You know, a lot of people live in places that don't really have a backyard or back porch or an outdoor space for a grill. There's no crime in using a skillet indoors. But I do hope you have a pretty good vent hood.
Yeah. A vent hood that can suck up a cat, as a friend of mine would say.
Yeah. I don't have a very good vent hood at home, so that's why we cook outside.
When you cook outside, do you ever use a skillet? Like, is there room for a cast iron skillet in steak cookery?
Totally. And I actually think some of the things that we figured out, we tried to figure out, this is kind of me wanting to kind of prove that, like, a filet mignon is, like, a really great piece of meat. I think, you know, across the country, people are like, big old ribeye, that's the king of steaks. But I really kind of like a filet. And, of course, we quickly found out that the best way to cook a filet, in our opinion, is in a cast iron skillet with a little bit of butter. And I have a couple cast iron skillets that I keep around just for putting down in the coals and on grills and stuff.
Talk to me about the reverse sear. I feel like a certain part of the internet has collectively decided that it's the best way to cook a steak.
Well, it can be the best way for certain cuts. It kind of goes back to that part cooking large cuts. I mean, reverse sear is exactly that. It's a reverse sear. You cook slow up front, and then you finish it off on a higher heat. The tricky part to that is, though, is that you cook, you let the meat rest, maybe cool down just a little bit so you don't overcook it when you put it on a really hot grill. But that really hot grill has to be a lot hotter than you would think it needs to be to overcome the cooked exterior of the part cooked steak. But I think, you know, I mean, the reverse sears, I think possibly Kenji came up with that term, but it's a really old school restaurant trick, really. You do that with big pieces of meat. It could be in a sous vide, which isn't my favorite way to cook steaks.
Hate that. Hate it.
I think it's pretty nice to be able to get some flavor from your heat source, be it like Maillard reaction from a grill or a hot skillet or some smoke or some charcoal or whatever. And sous vide doesn't really do that, but it does allow you to cook an almost perfect piece of meat. And that's essentially the reverse sear. So it could, you know, it's open to interpretation, I suppose.
Yeah, I've always wondered, though, the line that goes from perfection to variability, from bite to bite. I don't really want every bite to be the same.
Well, and I don't either. And that's kind of what Jordan and I figured out, because I've done a ton of sous vide steaks and just kind of playing around. And I think it's, you know, it has its application. If you're feeding 100 people one piece of meat at some fancy pants dinner somewhere, like, that's definitely the way to go. But really, I really like the gradient from the crust of a steak. And as it gets more and more rare in the middle, I like the thinner parts that are cooked a little bit more. I'm a big fan of textural differences.
Yeah, me too. So, I mean, you're known for your barbecue, obviously, which largely relies on indirect heat and from smoke that's being drawn across the meat, whereas cooking steak over live fire or in a pan is direct heat. Do you ever cook steaks using indirect heat?
Sure, totally. And we actually have one of the techniques in the book is for doing that on a Big Green Egg or a Kamado-style cooker, as I should say. But yeah, I mean, all the time, I think like ribeyes and tri-tips and other big pieces are kind of perfect for a slow smoke. I do it for ribeyes for events and stuff at Franklin Barbecue, but I think I really like the grilled flavors on certain types of meat. And a lot of times the smokiness of a larger cut of meat kind of overpowers that. And I think it confuses the palate a little bit. I like to have some clean, like grilled stuff going on. But if you got a smoker, I mean, I do it all the time. A lot of times, even if I'm building up a big grill, I'll just kind of do the steaks while I'm waiting for the coal, where I'm building up a coal bed, let them rest for a little bit, build up a coal bed, and then finish them off. And I think that kind of part is pretty fun about just experimenting with what you've got. There's no right or wrong way to cook a steak, or even really cook a brisket for that matter. I think as long as you're having fun and kind of being a little creative with it, I think that's pretty cool.
That's Aaron Franklin, perhaps best known for Franklin Barbecue in Austin. His book with Jordan McKay is Franklin Steak.
I think that people think that because there's millions of recipes, that there's really millions of different ways to cook things. But when you get down to it, it's like heat and time.
Every once in a while, a book comes along that you wish you had written. Where Cooking Begins by Carla Lolly Music is that kind of book for me. She's managed to describe with words the process I go through when I cook. It's shocking to read an actual description of what feels to me like a no-thinking, mostly feeling process. But Carla breaks it down, and she makes it understandable for those who are less fluent in the kitchen. I'm so happy to have her here with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great. It's interesting how much excitement there is around this book.
It's been really wild for me, too. It's been amazing. It's pretty funny to just be like, I wrote a cookbook and all of this is happening.
But I think it's because what you do at Bon Appetit, what exactly is your job title? Food director?
I'm the food director at Bon Appetit, yeah. So that means I oversee the test kitchen and all of the recipe content across all the platforms.
And even though people see you a lot on various platforms, there's something about a cookbook that is more personal.
True. Yes. I wanted to make sure that my voice came through in the book. So not only in the parts of the book where I was sort of talking about my approach to food, but also in the recipes themselves, which can honestly be a place where you don't get personal voice and you don't feel like someone's talking to you because we slip into this sort of textbook recipe language.
But what interests me about this book, what I find so fascinating is what you've done is you've really drawn this seamless line that exists for cooks who have fluency, where the act of shopping, organizing, prepping is intrinsic to the ability to just riff.
Yes, absolutely. I feel like people love to say, you know, if you start with great ingredients, you don't have to do anything to them. And it's one of those sort of slow food mantras. But if you're a beginner cook, like that isn't helpful at all. Because if the whole thing starts with ingredients, we should be talking about our ingredients more and how we get them into our houses and then what we do with them from there. So I really wanted to start with the inspiration for me that comes from picking out food. I know some people get really excited about like picking out their clothes. And that's the kind of shopping that gets them going. But for me, I really have fun shopping for food. And I talk to enough people who also just enjoy that. And then connecting the dots between, okay, you came home with this cool thing. What are you going to do with it?
But at the beginning of the book, you talk about there's fun shopping. And then there's what? Foundational shopping?
Functional.
Functional yep. shopping. Because not all shopping is fun. I mean, buying a bag of sugar.
Yeah. It doesn't actually matter if you pick it out or somebody else picks it out because every bag of sugar is the same once you know your brand. So I like to tell people that anything that comes in a box, a bag, a can, or a jar, you don't need to personally choose that. It doesn't bring a ton of value to the equation.
So we live in a world where there is an infinite number of recipes on the internet. And so it's hard to remember that, as you say, and I'm quoting, basically all foods can be cooked in a finite, manageable number of ways.
Correct. Yeah, I think that people think that because there's millions of recipes, that there's really millions of different ways to cook things. But when you get down to it, it's like heat and time, right? So time and temperature are the two things. And we haven't come up with, maybe the exception of sous vide and having electric pressure cookers, we haven't come up with new ways to cook things in like hundreds of years, right? And people think like, oh, I don't know how to cook that. It's like everything comes back to steaming, sautéing, pan roasting, high heat roasting, slow heat roasting, and confiting. I didn't include braising in the book because my technique chapter was very pared down to salt, pepper, olive oil, and lemon, and you can't really build a braise. So I use slow roasting as sort of that. It really mimics that. It's slow, steady, moist heat.
One of the things that I found really interesting in the slow roasting and also the confing sections were the canned tomatoes.
Yeah. So when I was working on the technique section, I kind of got it down to that list. And I knew that for every technique, I wanted to show a step-by-step instruction of how to do whatever it was. So so that you could see sort of in consecutive steps in a real kitchen how to go about doing this. The grids that are part of that technique section show you that you can do that, and we limited it to 12, but that you can take that same exact steps of instructions and apply it to 12 different ingredients that are going to be on the next page. And so when I was writing the book, I had to come up with, like, what are all these things going to be for the grid? And there are things you have to think about when you're putting a book together, like color and having a good mix of proteins and produce, having something unusual or something surprising. And I really was just messing around with the canned tomatoes as an experiment. Like, I thought that it would work. There was a slow roasted buttered tomato sauce that I had made in the past. So we tried slow roasting the tomatoes, and it was a total revelation. Like, concentrated their flavor, cooks off a lot of the water, changes the texture, and then you have this condiment that is transformed. It's added value. You get, when you confit it, you get all of the oil that's also infused with the tomato flavor. And it's just this, like, great, again, hands-off thing that you can have.
I also loved that it was taking an ingredient that, since the rise of the farmer's market, has been devalued.
Canned tomato?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, particularly for us out here, because we have this insanely crazy long season.
All right, try not to rub it in.
I'm sorry, with the addition of Baja California, uh-huh, Mexico. But we forget that canned tomatoes are, you know, tomatoes picked at their peak of ripeness.
Yes. Yeah.
And preserved.
Yeah.
They're just not in a pretty mason jar.
That's right. They're something you should always have, you know, and I feel the same way about canned beans and cans of coconut milk. Those are great flavor building things that are shelf stable, that are high quality, that have a lot of flavor.
So let's talk about the recipes. There's so many parts to how you build them that are really, really fun. So I am a celery lover.
Okay.
And
very divisive ingredient. I love celery too.
I find it hilarious that people don't like.
Oh, people are passionate in their hatred.
I know. Talk to me about this celery dish in the book.
Which one? The stir-fried celery and cabbage with the peanuts, right?
Yes.
So this is a stir-fried dish with celery, cabbage, bacon, some peanuts, and then I think there's soy sauce and some rice vinegar. And this was one where I actually went shopping in my refrigerator. I was hungry. I was home. I wanted to eat. I didn't want to have to, like, make a big thing about it. And that was what I had. I had half a head of green cabbage. I had some celery. And I don't know if you do this, but sometimes I just start pulling stuff out of the fridge as I'm sort of figuring it out. And then a few things will go back into the fridge if they don't make the cut. So that was, you know, I love sautéed celery. I like it sautéed so that it's still crunchy. It mellows its sort of bitterness. And when you cook it, it makes the juiciness more available in a weird way. So it might lose that like snappy, breaky celery vibe, but then you get a very crunchy, juicy, it still has all of its texture. And it just paired really well with the cabbage. And then I threw peanuts, salted peanuts on top because that was sitting in my pantry. I had some bacon. Bacon and cabbage go really great together.
So what if I didn't have bacon? What would be something else you could use that would give you that hint of, you know, proteinaceous right. umami?
Yeah, I think because it's savory and it's also salty and it is, like you say, it's got that umami. If you had mushrooms, you could throw mushrooms in. You know, if you had a leftover pork chop, for example, or if you had pancetta in your freezer, you could dice that up and toss that through. But I think the biggest thing that you lose when you take bacon out of a dish is really the saltiness. So add more salt, more soy, Bragg's.
Bragg's aminos.
Bragg's. Yeah, exactly. Bragg's aminos.
There were two ideas in the book that I particularly fell in love with. One is green beans in a sandwich.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's my ham and butter baguette that came about from a beach snack. When height of summer traveling with the family, I started bringing just buttered bread and leftovers to the beach because it was just easier than packing a lunch. And then as long as you don't get too much sand into your assembly, you can kind of use that bread and butter and put any of the leftovers in and make a sandwich. So that's where I had leftover green beans. I had the ham, the butter, the bread. And I was like, oh, this is great. I'm doing this more often.
And the idea of potato chips as croutons.
Yeah, potato chips are one of my favorite things to like crunch up and sprinkle over something. So I think that came about because I love potato chips in sandwiches, actually. And then you're getting this like layer of crunchiness without any of the work of actually making croutons. Plus, if you have, you know, you're gluten-free people, you can put potato chips on top of a Caesar salad instead of croutons, and that would probably deliver. It's just texture, right? It's fat, and it's texture, and it's salt, and it's crunch. So yeah, keep some kettle. I like the kettle-cooked potato chips because they have a lot of structure.
It's interesting. It's probably the one idea that's going to allow me to not finish a bag of potato chips.
Oh, great.
Just so I have that
handful. Nice. Also great on fried rice, crushed up potato chips.
Which got a gasp in the audience.
I know. Where it was like a gasp and then this like satisfied like, ooh.
Yeah, like a swoon almost.
It was pretty funny.
So if you were to pick a recipe that we haven't already broken down as like a sales pitch for the book.
So I wanted to write a book. I wanted to write a cookbook that was going to make people excited about shopping for food. Because food shopping is not a sexy topic. And in fact, when I was working on the book with my editor, she was like, the cold grocery thing is like a real buzzkill. And I knew that there was something there because of talking to people about food shopping and how many times I've been stopped in a grocery store or at the farmer's market with like a giant bunch of kohlrabi in my hand. And somehow I'm like a magnet for people who are like curious and confused, you know? So people who would come up and say like, what does one do with that? And I knew that there was something about people's love of food, love of cooking, natural curiosity, and kind of bringing that all together in a strategic way, in that I'm advocating that you shop online for certain ingredients, and also in kind of a romantic, indulgent, creative way, in that I want people to shop without recipes and be guided by what they actually find and the conversations they might have with the people who work in the store that they are shopping at.
Well, I think it's really a powerful book.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Carla.
My pleasure.
Carla Lawley Music is the food director of Bon Appetit magazine. Her new book is Where Cooking Begins. After the break, a new review from LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Finally, we go out with a new review from LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega.
Hi, Evan.
Where are we headed?
We're headed to downtown Los Angeles, specifically the Arts District, and we're about to head into Nightshade.
So Nightshade is truly like the hottest, hippest restaurant in LA right now.
Indeed. If you are active on Los Angeles Instagram, any of the food circles, I'm sure you've seen several of the dishes there on your feed in recent months.
Who is behind it?
So the chef behind Nightshade is Mei Lin. If you watch any amount of Food Network, I'm sure you're familiar with her. She was a champion on Top Chef. If you ate at Ink, Michael Voltaggio's restaurant a few years ago, then you probably ate a dish that she, you know, had some kind of involvement with. She was a sous chef there for around 3 years. So she's been a presence. She's very young still, but she's been a force to be reckoned with in Los Angeles cooking for a few years now.
And I understand that she comes from a restaurant family.
That's right. She grew up in the Midwest and her parents owned a Chinese restaurant. And it's, you know, a bit of her autobiography that you see pop up in a lot of her dishes.
I love that. So describe the menu.
The menu I would describe as very Los Angeles. She has a great facility with kind of mashing together different cultures, different flavors, different traditions on the plate. And what I really love about Mei Lin's cooking is just how smart it is. She takes a lot of chances. So a good example of it would be the Mapo Tofu lasagna. It's a dish that is not overtly, I would, you know, using quote marks, not overtly fusion-y. Like you don't look at it and think, oh, here's someone doing something really kind of, you know, attention grabbing. It's a subtle dish. She makes this really thin egg noodle, puts a Sichuan pepper infused ragu, pork ragu, and uses tofu cream, kind of pipes it in. It's a very subtle, kind of elegant dish. But if you really dissect it, you realize how smart it is.
What are some of the other dishes that are there? Maybe something that does refer to her Midwest Chinese restaurant heritage.
One of my favorite dishes is the congee. And if you followed her trajectory on Top Chef, you'll know she cooked the dish several times. She has a real connection to the dish, and it's got a real soulfulness to it. It's one of my favorite dishes. It's got XO sauce, pork, egg, crispy scallions. You kind of mix it up. Every bite is a little different. Got a little sweetness, got a little spiciness. Another dish that I can think of is the shrimp toast. So you probably know it as a dim sum staple, and she does a great job with it. The toast is very crisp. It's kind of like paved with a ground up shrimp. Really, again, another great comfort food dish. And I would say one of my favorite dishes that maybe doesn't point back to her childhood, but is very, I think, typical of her style, is a Sichuan hot quail dish. You know, quail is not the easiest bird to work with. It's kind of small. She manages to get so much flavor out of that meat, even though it's deep fried in this really spicy Sichuan peppercorn batter. But it's incredibly satisfying and very Los Angeles.
Is there a dish that points to her time at Ink where there was a lot of modernist technique going on?
Yeah, I would say any of her seafood dishes, they're very subtle yet complicated. So she has like a kompachi ceviche that she uses kimchi, gives it a little bit of funk. One of her more popular dishes, and I call it one of the most divisive dishes on the menu, is her bloomin' onion. You'll see the dish on many tables throughout the restaurant. It's a dish that really takes chances. So she has, if you're familiar with the chain restaurant Bloomin' Onion, she takes the deep fried onion, and instead of the typical ranch sauce, she uses a lime inflected kind of whipped coconut cream, and it's got a really assertive flavor. It wasn't really my thing, but I know people who love the dish, and I think it really speaks not only to her ability to try new things, which I think is great for any cook to do, but it really shows her having fun. I think a lot of the dishes you find at Nightshade are fun, which is not something you think of when you think of a serious chef, but she walks that line really well between just very cerebral cooking, but also fun.
And the desserts are quite something there.
So this restaurant has one of my favorite new dessert programs in the city. The chef de cuisine, I'll call him Chef Max Boonthanikit, I think is how you pronounce his name. He created a really lovely frozen dessert, coconut mousse dessert, which is served inside a ceramic coconut-shaped bowl. You have an amazing, like, coco de nata. You have little flecks of pineapple. The pudding itself is super creamy. It's got a little bit of dry ice, so it's also got, like, this theatrical essence about it when it comes out of the kitchen. He has a really good tangerine ice. So it's an almond sorbet, and it's covered up underneath rings of tangerine ice. So they're kind of interactive desserts. You need to take your spoon and kind of break through the ice to get to the icy frozen treat underneath. A lot of his desserts have this kind of interactive aspect about them. But they're really beautiful sculptural desserts, but they're also a lot of fun.
Is this a tasting menu restaurant, or do we get to order a la carte?
You definitely order a la carte here. It's a small plates restaurant, which is a format Angelenos are very much familiar with. You definitely want to bring a group with you so you can sample the menu.
Thank you so much, Patricia.
Thank you, Evan.
I've been talking with LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Scarsiga about Nightshade in downtown LA. Visit the Good Food website for a link to her LA Times review. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can always subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, please leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Paola Mardo, and Laura Kondarajan. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with a brand new edition of Good Food. Mm-hmm.